You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Sarah Custer.
And I'm Miranda Prynn.
Hi, Miranda. Welcome to the podcast. We haven't had you on in a while.
No, it's great to be back.
So, Miranda, you spearheaded this episode and really championed the topic of citizen science. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about how that started and where the inspiration for this episode came from?
Yeah, so I commissioned a campus resource a couple of months ago, written by Dame Professor Henrietta Moore of University College London, in which she argued that universities needed to transform the way they were doing research to bring in a greater diversity of voices and knowledge if they were going to successfully respond to a lot of the complex and emergent or growing problems. In her case, she's very focused on global inequality and kind of reframing prosperity. But her point was that universities could actually play a central role in working with communities on the ground to create and share really vital knowledge. And she pointed to citizen science as a way to unlock this, which got me really interested in the transformative potential of citizen science, because in more practical terms, it's quite a tricky thing to implement. So I wanted to ask her, Henrietta, who is founder and director of UCL's Institute for Global Prosperity, to talk to me a bit more and provide further insight really into the role that citizen science could play in shaping this innovative research.
Before we go into that, I'm wondering if there's some clarity that we need to make here in terms of the terms. Whenever you say citizen science, I also make connections with another term that I've heard, which is non-academic researcher. Are those all kind of the same thing?
I think broadly, yes. I'm sure there's nuances of difference in the exact terminology. What I am aware of is that the term citizen science is quite a European UK term. From what I can gather in the US, the use of the word citizen is seen in slightly different terms. It can be seen as more exclusionary, whereas in Europe and the UK, it's seen as a very inclusive and participatory term. So in the US, for example, I think participatory research, community science, I've seen civic science talked about. So there are quite a number of different labels for this. And also It covers a massive broad umbrella of different approaches in how to engage essentially non-academic people in this work. Now, Henrietta, I know you've spent many years engaging people in communities beyond the academy in your research. So can you start off by telling us why it is that you're so interested in citizen science or citizen social science?
Well, it's not just that I'm interested in it, I'm passionately committed to it. I mean, every single project that the Institute for Global Prosperity runs has citizen scientists on it. And what's important about that is that they should be fully embedded in all my research teams, because what I'm interested in is developing new ways of knowing, and from that to create new kinds of what I call knowledge ecologies. That's bringing different voices and perspectives into the research and starting from a different place. Because with research, if you keep starting from the same place, you have a tendency to end up with the same answer. And right now, if we just think about the situation we're in, and if the listeners just think about the situation we feel we're all inhabiting, not just here in the UK, but around the world, we have an idea that we're seriously stuck. And so citizen science is the beginning of that process of how do we get out of the one-way street that has its dead end that we currently feel that we're in. And that's why I think it's so important to the research. And from the citizen science, you build a whole lot of other forms of collaboration. So it isn't just the citizen science itself. It's the other people that citizen science allows you to bring into the research conversation that's really, really important.
What would you say are the attributes of a really effective citizen science project? And And perhaps what are some of the biggest challenges that you've faced?
Well, there are many ways of doing a successful citizen science project. And as many people listening to this podcast will know, and they might be even be involved in one of those brilliant citizen science projects, which is all about, for example, counting the birds in your back garden so that we can work out where birds are, how many there are, what their migration paths are. But the kind of citizen science that I'm in really has to begin with a very, very careful process of co-design. So you don't bring citizens in at the late stage. They're there at the beginning, working with the research team. So what's important about that is that their role is defining and working with the research team to define what is the problem. Because many different kinds of research come along and say, OK, we understand this community has a particular problem, say with sanitation. Let's go and ask everybody what they think they should do about sanitation. The kind of work we do starts earlier than that. It says, what is the problem? Is it sanitation or is it something else? And how will we get a handle on that problem? What's the actual nature of the problem with the sanitation, if it is a sanitation problem? So that's one of the things, is where you start. That's hugely important. The other is that citizen scientists have to be full members of the research team. And so for us at the IGP, yes, we do have people who come onto projects, and projects can be quite short running. But for all the areas that we work in around the world, we have established citizen science teams. And that's very important, because you have to be careful about who's on the citizen science team. Because if you're just choosing from a bunch of local residents, that could also include university professors or CEOs or doctors. It can include all kinds of people. But what we're really after in that community is the diversity of voices, and particularly those who are hardest to reach and who don't normally have a voice. So any project has to have a mechanism for getting to those members of the community who would not normally perhaps be putting themselves forward. And that is one of the big challenges, is how you do that. And there are a number of really difficult ethical issues that arise when you're trying to do that. Because sometimes what people think when they think about citizen science is they think, okay, you must be employing a sort of set of representative citizens. And that's actually not what we're doing. What we're looking for is diversity of perspective. And the way we get that diversity is by working closely with other partners. So this is local civil society organizations, small businesses, other groups of people in the community who can suggest how we should be approaching a problem and how we might start to recruit and then train our citizen scientists. But once you've got them, they have to be equal members of the research team. And that in itself requires really good training.
Yeah, just on your point of co-designing right from the start, even to focus on defining the very question around which the research will be focused, it conjures up the kind of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The answer is 42, but what is the question? And
yeah,
that seems so fundamental, but I can see it's not something that is always considered when involving those outside of the research academy walls. So in terms of involving these participants, citizens in the process, how can researchers ensure these projects are designed so that the participants themselves do see tangible benefits? That there is often criticism of the way researchers from wealthier nations approach research in the global south. You have done and still do a lot of work in, for instance, Kenya. So, you know, drawing on your own experience, how have you avoided falling into that trap? How do you ensure that those involved are benefiting?
Well, I think the starting point, as you've suggested, is understanding what you think knowledge is and what it's for. So knowledge is not a single body of knowledge that can only be advanced by those who already possess it. We have to find some way of bringing in these alternative voices. And that really is the key to it. But you have to do it with a set of methodologies and mechanisms that you've built up over time. And you learn those not just from research colleagues or from other spaces and places, but actually from the citizen scientists themselves. So one of the things we start with is, you know, how will you be involved in this research? What would you like to see as the outcome? And as we said, what is the question? But we also approach all the other collaborators who are involved in that, because when we're dealing with an issue, say the work we've done around Euston in London on the Good Life Euston project, you know, this was about working not just with the citizen scientists, but with a whole group of other people, including local authority, Camden Council, various businesses, Camden Giving, Euston Young Voices, all sorts of youth organisations. And they themselves have an idea about how you should build a community of knowledge and how you should think about and reflect on the distributions of power that will exist in any community of knowledge, and how you work towards a problem so that you can navigate your way around that. And I think if you're talking about the Global South, I think one of the things we need to be very clear here, if you're talking and speaking about Africa, is that the research with citizen scientists in Africa is fundamentally different from much research that's been carried out in Africa before, because its starting point is Africa. Its starting point is the perspective of those people who are living in those communities, and then the other groups around them who interact with them and have to care for them. Its starting point is not, we have a theory of structural transformation that the economy is going to go through, and which stage are you in that process?
Yeah, so it's not a top-down approach. It's a grassroots approach to research.
But it's more than that, because it requires a development of a capacity for research within the community and within the collaborators. And that's one of the things that people often forget. So it isn't just a matter of consulting people or going to interview them or asking them to participate in a few focus groups. It's actually a different kind of process. It's a process of bringing people together collectively to drive forward the process of research itself. And although that might sound a little opaque, in on the ground, it makes a fundamental difference to actually how you do the research. So you're starting from Africa. So the theories, so it's not just about what is knowledge, although that's part of it, but it's also about local people's theories. So what are people's theories of politics or of climate change or of economics? And very often in Africa, one of the interesting and clever things that people quite often say, because governments in Africa, like governments everywhere, keep talking about the importance of GDP going up. And if you go and ask someone in a rural area in Kenya about GDP, they'll say, well, the problem with GDP is that you can't eat it.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier training. I suppose that's a big part of it, that this is a knowledge exchange between all participants. You mentioned GDP, and I know that a lot of your work has focused on challenging traditional economic models and trying to reframe our understanding of prosperity. You've just given a really good example there of speaking to someone living in a rural village in Kenya. But can you tell us a bit more about this work and why, in a broader sense, involving grassroots communities has proven so important and effective?
I think it's important for a number of reasons. First of all, macroeconomic policy works with aggregate data. And very often you find when you are living your life, when you're experiencing it in the way that you do anywhere around the world, you often find that the kinds of policies that are based on aggregate data are not really addressing the issues that are important to you. So that's the first question. What is actually happening to you economically? The second thing, I think, is that we've lived for a very long time governed by a kind of productivist notion of economics, where all we want to do is increase GDP and then everybody else will somehow be miraculously better off, either through a theory of trickle down or through a similar theory of, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. But we found ourselves in recent years in a rather horrifying situation where we now have extreme poverty, even in the global north. And this is because economic prosperity, apparent growth for our economies, has become decoupled from social and environmental well-being and prosperity. we've lost the ability to understand what should government policy be about. So the argument we make in the IGP is that if you focus only on economic growth through GDP, you will have the kind of exclusion, long-running systemic injustice and inequality that we currently have, and the kind of populist policies and responses that are now such a difficult part of contemporary politics. What we ought to be thinking about is how can people have a better quality of life? What is it that makes societies flourish? And one of the things that's really important there is a lot of the work that we've been doing, rather than starting with economics and saying, okay, if we have economic growth, everyone will get better off. We've actually been working to show that you get better off if you start with building social solidarity. So what's really important for people is the more that they connect, the better they do in coming up with solutions to problems and driving economic innovation.
Yeah, so when you say better off there, you don't mean necessarily in a purely financial sense, that is in a holistic human well-being sense.
It is in a larger sense, but it's also in a sense that says, if you, for example, think about the importance of your economy as GDP growth and making a profit and paying shareholders, then you're very likely to end up with a whole lot of people in that economy who are very badly paid. And you'll also be treating important environmental issues as externalities to that model. Now, if you start from a different perspective and said, OK, what do these communities themselves think that they need in order to flourish? How can they draw on the resources they have to drive new kinds of social innovation in communities? You will find that that also drives economic innovation. And so you will actually create new kinds of economic opportunities. And you will also, in addition to things like participation, recognition, self-determination, aspiration and hope, have better economic outcomes.
Interesting. Your point that aggregate data or economic models are not necessarily reflective of, or not reflective of, human experience is one of the key arguments I often read around why we need the humanities and social sciences to actually delve into the complexities. I know your work is fairly interdisciplinary in its approach. Would you agree with that argument? Do you think that is one of the fundamentals to all of this?
I think it's absolutely one of the fundamentals because, again, we need these different perspectives on problems from different disciplines. And here, you know, the humanities and the social sciences have a lot to contribute, which we've been neglecting for a very long period of time. So, for example, if people think of challenging circumstances in the UK at the moment, they probably are not going to turn, as a starting point, to questions about culture and identity and belonging. But when you actually listen to what people are talking about, the challenges of their lives in the UK, yes, inflation, yes, no one can pay their energy bills, yes, life is pretty miserable. But the other side of it is that people feel disconnected. They feel that they're not being listened to. They don't have a voice. They can't participate. All of those things are hugely important. So you need to bring these effective and targeted interdisciplinary, or as I would say, transdisciplinary approaches to the problems that we face.
Yeah, we haven't got long, so I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about the new Citizen Science Academy that has been launched relatively recently and what it's kind of set out to do, where it's got to so far.
Well, the UCL Citizen Science Academy is based at the Institute for Global Prosperity. It's been designed in partnership with University College London's Office for Open Science, and also with the cross-faculty Citizen Science Working Group. It was launched in April. We brought citizen science teams from the Middle East and from Africa to join the citizen science teams that we have here in London to do that launch and to start a process of cross-knowledge transfer between all of the citizen science teams around the world. What we're doing is developing in different forms of collaboration and different partnerships, training and educational modules for citizen science. So this can be anything from how do you do interviews to how do you use GPS to how do you can you learn to use a computer to how can you make a presentation, how do you do data analysis, and so on and so forth. And we're training now citizen scientists for the UK, and we have similar facilities in the Middle East and Africa for training there too. But this, the academy here, in my view, as I said at the launch, is the most significant thing that a university has done since universities admitted women. Because when you train at this Citizen Science Academy, you will be accredited. And you can come from any background, any level of education, any walk of life, and come into this work. And you will receive a certificate for the training that you do, and you will be part of the community that's produced that collective training.
Fantastic. So can anyone apply for this training, or do they need to have been engaged or got involved with an existing research project?
They need at the moment to be engaged with an existing research project, of which there are many. And since we launched the Academy, happily for me and my team, we now have lots and lots and lots of new projects that we're being asked to take on and to consider.
So these projects reach beyond UCL, I presume?
Oh, yes, of course, around the world, and with all the collaborations that we run around the world, but also just with many, many people outside UCL.
Yeah, brilliant. Finally, to wrap up, what is your top line advice to an academic researcher wanting to launch a citizen science project?
My top line advice would be to remember that you will need to start by defining what your research project is about with the people you're going to be working with. So don't come with the framework and the answer and the question fully formed, because if you do, you will miss the best parts of what citizen science is really about.
Thank you so much for speaking to me today, Henrietta. It's been absolutely fascinating. I hope to speak to you again at some point in the future.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Henrietta there repeated what is often said of citizen science or civic science, and that you have to include the non-academic partners from the very beginning. It's almost as soon as you conceive of a notion of including them in some sort of research project, you need to identify who you're going to be working with and exactly what the problems are that they want to focus on, which is something we've heard a lot, but it's always good to just remind people of how important that is. And I totally get your point of why you were inspired to speak with Henrietta to begin with, about how I really liked how she was connecting it to the greater issues within our society and politics, and kind of addressing those divisions that we're seeing in a lot of Western democracies right now, and arguing that citizen science creates greater social cohesion, which leads to happier people and even ultimately greater economic outcomes.
Yeah, and it does sound like UCL are really leading the way on this. I was particularly interested by this new Citizen Science Academy and the fact they are now offering training, so much training to non-academics in research methods. So this is very much a two-way knowledge flow, which seems to sit at the heart of it. And actually, the importance of that training process really came through loud and clear when I spoke to one of the citizen scientists that UCL have been working with in Kenya on their Prosperity Co-Laboratory Africa project, or Procol Africa, a farmer called Joel Bitok. Joel was originally approached by dint of being a community leader, but he's been able to act as a sort of conduit of information between these researchers and the Maumara communities in Kenya, and really draw lots of other people into this research.
Great, let's go to Joel.
I am joined today by Joel Bitok from Nandi County in Kenya, who is chairperson of the Tindaret Community Forest Association, as well as chairperson of the Umbogo River Water Resource Users Association. And Joel has been working with academics on the Procol Kenya project for, is it 4 years now, Joel?
It's 4 years. I am a farmer by occupation, and I lead conservationist. I am also a trained citizen scientist who have worked with Procol for the last 4 years. And I've been passionate with interacting with farmers, the local communities within the Mau Mara community.
I was hoping you actually could start by telling us a bit about the research project that you are involved with and what your specific role is there.
I have been in this research for the last 4 years, but before then, we came together as Procol. We had to undergo a training, which was facilitated by the University College of London. And thereafter, we had to engage communities, discussing with them, trying to learn how they live, how they interact with themselves within the communities. And we started to know about their backgrounds, how they behave, the indigenous life they use, they live. And thereafter, because we saw most of the communities living within Mau, they understand our dialect, so we interact with them freely, unlike some few communities in the lower side of Ma community. And we have around 10 subtribes or 11 subtribes within the Mau. So we basically interact on trying to learn on how they farm, the cultural lives, and try to assist them, to teach them on the current or scientific methods of maybe farming, the new technologies in the way they cook, the kind of food they do in their farms, and other activities within, including even the medicinal part. You know, Africans like indigenous kind of system. So we try to teach them and confer them to the modern system.
Okay, brilliant. So you've talked about working with the indigenous communities on a number of different elements of the way they live. But what is the broad aim of the project?
I believe that the major objective of our projects is to improve their livelihoods within the Mau complex in terms of the way they do the climate part and the prosperity part. So we want their lives to get improved from the systems they currently live in, because you find them, some of them still live in conditions that needs to be improved.
So really your role is a kind of liaison between the academic researchers and the people living in this part of Kenya, and
yes,
actually collecting information that really paints a picture of how their lives are lived and what will really make a difference to them. Is that the idea?
That is the idea, indeed.
And so how did you get involved in the project? How did that come about?
You know, being a leader, you know my background, I've been elected as a leader of a community who are doing basically the water resource management issues within our local communities. So we had to start with them, the people whom we know. We start by training them. We invited my colleagues, and through meetings, we had to design for agribusiness. We targeted the businessmen. We targeted the women, local communities who are doing farmers. We targeted those who are interested in conservation activities like environmental issues. So we had to design our approach along the passion of each communities. We had the herbalists. So we had to design a model for each so that we could interact with them and understand them. We had farmers. We had those people who are passionate about farming. So our soils are rich for farming, and we had to understand, to portion out the groups. We have the youths who are passionate about environmental issues, businesses. So we targeted them according to their lines, and we offered them prosperity trainings within our setups.
So the research, you actually very much helped design what the research was looking at, based on the different interest or focus areas of different groups within the community. And did it start with academics from University College London actually contacting you, or were you working with an organisation that was already involved with the university? How did that initial contact start?
No, the initial contacts were we were trained as TOTs. The group leaders within our groups were trained. Personally, I was trained. Then I came downward now to train others using almost similar model.
And what does that training process involve?
It involves agroforestry, clean energy, landscape restoration. For example, in terms of clean energy, we wanted to understand the systems our women use to cook within our area, within the Mau Mara ecosystem. And we had to undergo a research to ask them how, what they use. We prepared some like a questionnaire, some forms so that we could interact with them and ask them how to how they live with in terms of cooking, fuelwood, and most of them we could understand after analyzing the research. We came to understand that most of them have challenges. They are using the old system of cooking, so we had to give them alternatives to train them on alternative clean energy methods, like using the biogas, the briquettes, and other methods, so that we could reclaim the nature.
So you're trained in these various different areas, and obviously your knowledge, I imagine, you've gained a huge amount of knowledge in the process. Have you also had sort of training into research methods themselves? You know, research is very much something that certainly in the UK is always seen as the forum of professional academics who kind of know how to apply proper methodologies.
That
Is
was
that
the
right?
initial it, that was the initial stage of training. We had to understand the research, the entire research process, the methodology, how to analyze the data, the professional way of conducting ourselves during the research. That is the that was the initial training from the University College of London we
Okay,
had.
brilliant. Why do you feel that this type of citizen engagement in research is important? What benefits do you think it brings?
The greatest benefits is that once our communities acquire the knowledge and the skills, they change the kind of they do things. For instance, when it comes to agriculture, most of our communities maybe have been using the old systems of farming, but once they are trained to understand the kind of farming, the training of the systems of the entire value chain of the crops they are working on, at least they will understand and they will have a system to network so that at the end of the day, the entire value chain, the entire process will have some kind of value within their lives. So at the end product of it, they will their livelihoods will have to improve because the entire system have been improved.
Yeah, so you're able to see really tangible benefits within
They
these
are
communities.
very, very tangible. From the systems that we have put in place within the Mau ecosystem, we can see the results, the positive results from the trainings.
Can you give any other examples of what those results are? What has emerged from it?
We have realized also from the research we have conducted within the area, the kind of approach our communities are using now is better than the previous because we have managed to put in technology which previously they had not thought of. For instance, the media. The media has actually assisted in terms of giving out the information to the various members of our community, teaching them through the radios and social media. So those are modern technology we have used.
From your perspective as a citizen scientist, what do you think needs to be considered in the design and the management of citizen science projects to ensure that they are a success for all of those involved in them?
I think the systems of the model that needs to be developed should be developed in a simple that can be in a simple language that can be understood by the local communities. You know, English is a language that we embrace in Kenya, but in Kenya we have different sub-tribes within the local community. So I would suggest that in the coming models, we can break down even to simple languages like the Swahili and other linguistic that are embraced within the Kenyan community. So I think that could be one of the major attributes I would suggest. Secondly, is the systems of trying to do the publicization through public participation. You know, getting directly involved with the people of the lowest cadre in the society. You know, within the setups of a community, there are those people who are academics and those people who, when most of them who have not even gone to school, the old, the young, the marginalized in the society, people living with disability, those are people groups we would consider. They should also be involved in this system.
Of course, and then that empowers them and hopefully gives them greater agency for their own change, which is hugely powerful. So it sounds like you've achieved a huge amount through Procore Kenya already, but what do you still hope to achieve through this project? Are there any particular ambitions?
I think we intend to expand our activities throughout the local communities within our area because we have not managed to reach all. Some of them we have trained, but we intend to expand our systems to at least we cover a bigger area than the ones we have done before. Secondly, I'd suggest that we would still consider lobbying along the youth and women who are, I can say they are majority in the society. Those are the people who can, at least they have the energy, they have the passion, and they I think those are the people who will influence change according to our look.
And finally, do you have any advice for anyone who is an aspiring citizen scientist, who's sort of maybe considering whether they should get involved in something like this?
Yes, I would request that going forward we would wish to consider expanding the number of people who can afford to have this training so that we have quite a good number of citizen scientists within our country and we expand this model so that it can reach different parts. You know, for this case we have measured in the Mau Mara. And Mau Mara basically has touches around 5 to 6 counties within Kenya. So I would wish that more people are get trained to be citizen scientists.
And now you've got a test case to show what a difference it can make within one community. So hopefully that can provide a launch pad to successfully expand it into further areas, further communities.
Secondly, I would request that the whole world is talking about the climate change issue, the issue of decarbonization. So we'd wish that the research towards mitigation measures and ways of building the resilience towards this climate change would focus our minds also on the issue of climate so that we can work together in this part.
Which, as you say, is a hugely important issue, all around the world. Look, thank you so much for joining us today, Joel. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you. I hugely appreciate you giving up your time.
Thank you, Elsa.
It's always really refreshing to hear from people who aren't academics or involved in higher education, but are part of the networks of the people that we're working with. And I think Joel's a great example of that. And I loved hearing how he's engaged with the researchers and what he's taken from the UCL training. And he clearly believes in the power of citizen science to the point that he's working to expand it even further into a bigger geographical area and also bringing in more participants like women and young people from his communities.
Yeah, his passion is clear, isn't it, right from the start, that he really truly believes in the transformative potential of this work. He did also point to the fact that he has already, and others have already been able to see notable benefits among participants from Manwara communities. He talks about, you know, methods of cooking and all being more energy efficient and so on. And that's fantastic. Although it is important to note that this is just one form of citizen science project. I mean, it can take so many different shapes and therefore many different motivations for people getting involved. This idea that we as the ordinary citizen, whatever that may be, can make a difference is in itself really empowering.
And I wonder if we can clearly see from Joel's example that this is having a real impact on the communities. But I wonder if what sort of long-lasting impact this can have on a government level or a public policy level that will go beyond just the individual lives of the actual citizen scientists.
And that is yet to be fully unraveled, actually. It's what I spoke to our next guest, Professor Alan Irwin, who's a leading scholar in the study of citizen science, currently based at the Department of Organization at Copenhagen Business School. Something Alan is really interested in is that exact question. Mm. And he admits he doesn't, you know, have all the answers. I think one of the key challenges that needs to be overcome in terms of the policy impact is concerns around the quality control and reliability of working with people who are not academic researchers trained in research methodology, but, you know, potentially the fact that, for instance, UCL is training people in research methodology goes some way to answering that problem. Alan, great to speak to you.
Hello there. Yes, nice to talk to you too.
I'm interested, what originally sparked your interest in citizen science?
Yeah, that's an interesting one for me, because I was writing about these things, you know, way back in the 80s and early 90s. And to be honest, the label citizen science wasn't used at that point. So you could say I was interested in citizen science before it had that name, even though, of course, I'm not saying it was invented in the 1990s, because there are certainly lots of examples going back in time are things that we might now call citizen science, but they didn't use that term then. But I think, you know, two things really caught my attention. One was the idea, which to me is pretty basic, that public groups, citizens, if you want to call them that, have a legitimate contribution to make to research, to knowledge, to understanding. Very simply, people know stuff. They build up knowledge of perhaps it's their local environment or healthcare. And that seems to me to be a legitimate and important input. So one thing is the kind of idea that people can be knowledgeable too. And then the second thing, which was also always has been very important for me, was the science and society angle. The idea that it's legitimate and important for members of society, again, let's call them citizens, to engage with issues of science and technology in a constructive way, and not simply, you know, in the way of saying, oh, we don't like this, or we'd like to try to stop that, but a more constructive relationship between science and society.
Yeah, because in many ways, you know, there's a strong argument that science should serve society to a certain extent. I suppose the more engaged the public in a broad sense is with that process, the easier it will be to ensure that that happens. How have you seen it evolve over that period? I mean, particularly perhaps the last 20 years.
Yeah, hugely would be the simple answer to that. I think, citizen science, I mean, remember, in the 90s, it wasn't a term that was widely used or widely recognized. I mean, it didn't really have a strong meaning then. So it's huge development, just in terms of the numbers of citizen science initiatives and the amount of attention it gets. Particularly in Europe, for example, but you see it very much in EU activities that citizen science has become a very recognized term and something that a lot of people feel is an important contribution. And I'll just say one more thing. I mean, one big difference between thinking back 20, 30 years ago about citizen science and today is the way in which the internet, IT, smartphones have really enabled citizen science initiatives. That is one thing when I was thinking about this in the 90s, I couldn't even imagine. So there's something about the way modern communications and particularly the accessibility of things like smartphones has opened up citizen science in lots of ways, which are really very different from the discussion 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, I can see that. That connectivity must be a huge aid, and also the fact it facilitates such ease of data input from such a broad audience must have absolutely revolutionized it. With that in mind, what are, would you say, the most common models of a citizen science project that you observe?
Yeah, I mean it's interesting because I mean one thing which always excites me, I think, and captures my imagination, is the range of different activities that people can engage in and that they can identify. So there are lots of ways of trying to capture that. But one way, and there are other ways of doing this, one way I think about it is basically according to two kind of axes. One is scale. So you have on the one hand really big databases with thousands and thousands of participants, a kind of crowdsourcing research. So on the one hand you've got that mega scale, and on the other hand you've got kind of hyper local initiatives, literally in people's back garden. Perhaps they're observing birds in their back garden or something like that. So you have big scale versus small scale. And then the other one, if I'm allowed to put two axes in, would be something about motivation. You have citizen science projects which are, let's call it, very action oriented. Perhaps it's a campaign, or perhaps it's a concern that people have about an area. So it's very much, citizen science for a strong purpose. And then the other end, you have the kind of citizen science initiatives, which are very much about curiosity, just wanting to find out about the world. I think a lot of school-based projects have that. You want to get people's interest in research, and so let's start by looking at the frogs, around the sports field, and you're not thinking anything more than that's a way of getting people interested in biology and the environment and how these things interact.
And actually, on that, the last point of the kind of passion projects, I always think of a lot of the people engaged with astrophysics, citizen science projects around asteroid spotting. And there seems to be a huge amount of enthusiasm across the world, really, in that particular space. Your point on the scale versus the hyperlocal, I was just thinking one of the things technology, I suppose, has hugely helped with is actually in linking those two things up. So you can have people making hyperlocal observations. You reference, for instance, your back garden counting birds or butterflies or whatever it might be. But of course, those observations can then be collected at scale. You can invite them from millions of people around a country or a region. Do you think that is something new that technology has facilitated, or were there kind of ways to try and do that prior to the smartphone?
Yeah, I mean the point is that of course you could always communicate that, you know, of course, there are natural history societies if we're staying with birds and bees and butterflies, you know, but for people who are not really, you know, amateur bird watchers or people who are perhaps so dedicated as to be a member of some local society, definitely the fact that, you know, what do? We go online and find out information, perhaps from other parts of the country. I know very much with bird watching, for example, many of my friends who are keen bird watchers will immediately start looking. We have a national database in Denmark to say, no one else has spotted that bird in this area. So it gives a new, you might say, new level of interest, and perhaps it makes you a little bit aware. It might make you think, oh, perhaps it wasn't a golden eagle I saw in my back garden because no one else has seen one. Or, you know, other people have spotted the same thing. So it definitely brings a new immediacy. And I think when it works well, it's a good way of connecting the things that you're seeing, you know, as I said, very hyper-locally in your backyard or wherever, with larger discussions. And sometimes it makes you think, you know, what's happening here? Why is no one else observing this? Is it because I'm wrong? Or is there something interesting happening? So there are many examples of that, of people getting in touch with each other. And, you know, there are different motivations. Sometimes there's almost a competitive element there in terms of what you see and what other people might miss. But I think also, you know, it can give a sense of purpose that you're part of something bigger. You know, there's a movement. Other people are looking at plastic pollution in their local stream. And that can make it seem like not a small thing, but actually something quite important.
Yeah, and give people a sense of agency. I mean, you referred to the motivations that can be kind of local concerns, but I think all of us can feel a bit powerless sometimes in the face of fairly intractable problems. So I can see if you're then engaging with other people that might be actively partaking in things that are trying to sort of address or find out about local issues, that also have a wider impact. That gives you a real sense of empowerment, or could give someone a real sense of empowerment.
And that's quite exciting, because I think for many people, and now I'm not talking about professional researchers, for people who don't think of themselves as experts, you know, I'm just curious, and perhaps you're working with your family, or perhaps it's a neighborhood thing. You know, we're not clever scientists, you know, we're just observing. So the sense that what you are doing there can actually be taken much more seriously, you know, it can have some larger impact. I think for many people, that's a bit shocking and a bit worrying, but also very exciting to think that, you know, they're not just, you know, people without any knowledge of research or any knowledge of biology or whatever it is, but they're connecting to something much larger. And citizen science is a way of acknowledging that and taking it seriously. It's not just a bunch of kids doing stuff in their science hour. They're actually also part of a European discussion about what's going on with plastics pollution, for example, in the local stream.
Taking that one step further, what do you make of that claim that this sort of broad public engagement in research could really offer solutions to some of these seemingly insoluble global issues that we face, whether it be relating to climate change, sustainability, inequality, take your pick, really. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, one thought is that this isn't, and I say this with some feeling because it's a point that sometimes come up, you know, people say, oh, are you saying that citizen scientists, you know, without any formal qualifications, are better at doing this than recognized researchers? And that's not a helpful discussion. That's not the point, of course. It's about having mutual respect on all sides, including, you know, the expertise and the knowledge that a trained researcher brings to these things. But I think it is a way of making people feel connected. It's a way of saying that what you're doing is important, both in terms of getting engaged in something which captures your imagination, but also in contributing to knowledge. I think there's often a challenge of turning big problems, climate change, to take that as an example, to turn them into something that connects with people in their everyday lives, you know, apart from making them feel bad. You know, what can I do about that? So there is something about turning, you know, big and extremely important issues into something which connects with perhaps a local community or a particular initiative. That's often a challenge that the big language and government policy making, IPCC, are really important things. But for many people, it's, yeah, but where do I come into that and how do I contribute? So I think engaging citizens is a way of making these things come alive. And then sometimes it's a way of asking slightly different questions, you know, because people will notice things which are perhaps seem rather trivial, like the change of species, you know, plants or birds in the local area, and start to ask questions which can really help scientists, because the starting point can often be a citizen science type of action. So, yeah, I think it can broaden and it can make people feel that they have a contribution to make to these really important but very big issues.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about the question, because having spoken to Professor Henrietta Moore, who does a lot of work on citizen science projects all over the world, and one of the key tenets that she put forward around how they design these projects is that they're engaging with people living, working, going about their lives from the very start to actually frame the questions that are being asked and design the project. It's not a case of designing it and then going out and getting people involved afterwards, which seems that could be a very, very powerful process because it just broadens the perspective so much. On that, what role do you think citizen science could or perhaps should play in public policy making?
Yes, I think for policy making, I think I might say there's good news and there is news which isn't exactly bad, but which could certainly be challenging for policymakers. And we need to think about that. The good news is, I mean, take an example. We saw this during the continued pandemic around COVID, of course. You know, there are many citizens getting involved in doing data analysis, often posting that on social media, perhaps asking questions or drawing attention to things which people and the policy pressure simply don't have time or resources to pick up. So it's not hard to see how, you know, that kind of information can be an input. It can also be a way of communicating among people about, well, what's going on with COVID and what are the possibilities? So that's good. I think the challenge for policymakers is that this information isn't coming from the recognized experts. It's not Professor, you know, Irwin from whichever university you want to pick. It's people who you don't know, and it's often coming in, for example, through social media. And of course, there are lots of other things going on in social media, which perhaps aren't so very helpful, conspiracy theories of all kinds, etc. So I think on the one hand, there's a tremendous resource for policymaking, not least in terms of helping perhaps reframe the questions. Are we putting that question about risk, for example, in the right way? Are we taking account of younger people or older, more vulnerable people, etc.? But I think sometimes for the policymaker, it's like, hoo-ha, you know, it's difficult to process this. It's simpler when you invite someone in for a coffee to talk it over, whereas absorbing citizen science information, which I think is very important, perhaps needs policymakers to rethink a little bit. And this point, which to me is basic to citizen science, that people have got a contribution to make, not just as citizens, but also as people who can be knowledgeable. I don't think all policymakers see it like that. I think policymakers might say, okay, it's a political thing, but many of them wouldn't get that this can be a really valuable resource in terms of knowledge and understanding of what's going on. So I think that's something which policymakers perhaps need to think about as citizen science gets more and more important. Perhaps how do they have to operate differently in order to really listen to some of these important messages?
Yeah, and I have a certain sympathy. I can see that there would be concerns around quality control and the trust and reliability of the evidence. As you have pointed out, there's an awful lot of misinformation or sort of misunderstood or misrepresented facts online. But also, of course, policymakers have always traditionally relied on experts because those are the people who are trained in the scientific method. And therefore, arguably, can be trusted to have carried out research and thus be basing their findings on very well orchestrated work. This I can see is a very challenging area. I mean, what do you have any thoughts on how that can be addressed and how that quality control element can be overcome?
Yes, I have a lot of sympathy with the policymaker too. Just to say that, because I can see, and COVID is a particular example where people are working under great pressure, and you can see how getting this extra data source could be challenging. I can easily understand that. But one lesson is to go back to this point about the kind of questions that are being framed, to understand that this is intelligence, in the broader sense of that term. This is people perhaps pointing to things which you might have missed when you're making these pressured decisions. And I think, one of the hardest things to do when you're working under pressure is to keep listening, and particularly listening for, well, are we missing something? Is there something going on? A group of us here, is led by a colleague here in CBS, Sina Zambak, was studying what we call citizen data scientists. So these were people working during the COVID epidemic in Denmark. And you could see that they quickly were finding more imaginative ways of presenting the data. Many of them were doing that, re-representing data in ways that people found much more accessible than their other, standardized statistics. So there's a great example of how it's a supplement to policymaking. There perhaps was an understandable challenge about how to communicate, and many people are rather clever at manipulating this data and showing it in a positive way and showing it in a way that was much more accessible. But it probably took many of the policymakers a while to notice that actually they were missing things in terms of how they were communicating, and that people with a little bit of time and energy were rather smart at that. So it's always back to listening to these messages, of being willing to accept that there are things you could do better, and more than that, willing to accept that perhaps what the priorities are from a policymaker's side are not widely shared in society. And that seems to be crucial if you're going to have legitimacy around decisions, to be able to hear these things and, if necessary, disagree or push back. But you have to have the capacity to absorb those messages.
Yeah, to listen and learn, and as you say, actually acknowledge the huge wealth of knowledge that can be drawn from all corners of society. Maybe you don't feel this is the case, but from what I have read, there is a feeling that academics and universities have been quite slow to embrace citizen science. Clearly, it is an expanding area, but that often involves organisations kind of sitting slightly outside of the higher education sector. If that is a fair comment, why do you think that might be that academics and universities have been a bit slower to really embrace this?
Well, that's a really, really interesting question. And I think I would want to say that probably that's something which varies a lot across the university. So, to say, if you think of that, I mean, in geology and natural history and archaeology, I mean, amateur science, or what we might now call citizen science, was around long before the university departments were there. So there's always been a foundation. I don't think archaeological projects could go very far without lots of enthusiastic volunteers and, people prepared to do work, often very little compensation. But I think, and so that's one thing, it's varied. And then I think there are concerns about quality control, which academics are often very quick to point out. I tend to say, yes, of course, and that's a standard part of any research project. We should be worried about quality control. But it isn't to say that citizen science projects necessarily a problem in that regard, particularly if it's big numbers. After all, observations tend to even out, or particularly when you're working with people who can be quite skilled. It's identification, for example, whether that's astronomy or ornithology. But then I think there is something more than that. I think sometimes one might argue that the promotion and the incentives in universities might not encourage people to get, I mean, academics, to get so involved in citizen science projects. It can easily sound like a nice thing to do, but not somehow serious in terms of really doing high quality academic research. Obviously, I disagree with that, but I can also see how academics, also under pressure for time, could think, oh, I don't have time for this. It's nice to work with a local school or a group of people in the community, but it's not as high a priority as going to an academic conference or publishing a new paper. So that's a challenge, I think, in terms of communicating what citizen science can do in a balanced way and making it obvious that for many researchers, this is something which hopefully will assist, but also in a positive way, provoke them to think differently. If I just make one comment about that, I remember talking to one very senior professor who said, well, you know, you can go to academic conferences and you meet your colleagues. You kind of know what they're going to be saying because we're working on the same issue. This person had connections with industry and said, yeah, I'm used to talking to people from industry and they have your particular problems, of course, and I get that. But when I'm talking to citizen scientists, I never really know what I'm going to get, you know, because people can come with all sorts of perspectives and all sorts of knowledge. And basically what I'm saying is you should see that as an opportunity and as a resource rather than in any way a distraction from your main activities.
The call is for this to be taken more seriously, really. And I can see in a competitive environment, which academia undoubtedly is, people are going to focus on what they would consider the kind of higher prestige work. So I guess there's room for this to be pushed more in that direction, to be kind of acknowledged for the power that it can wield.
Yes, I think potentially, you know, if you think through citizen science and imagine a situation where, you know, and this is, you know, the positive scenario of more people being involved in these projects, people seeing it as a very valid opportunity. I think it's an advantage for academic departments, but it could, of course, could also mean that it's something where they have to say, well, are we going to be part of this or are we going to be on the sidelines, so to say? And I think it would be better for academic departments to say, yeah, we can work with this, which means thinking through. I mentioned data quality. Ethics is another issue, for example, which is discussed now among citizen science participants. How can we be sure that there are the same ethical standards in citizen science work that we hopefully are applying in our academic research? I think that's a very legitimate issue. Also, questions about diversity and inclusion, they also come up in the context of citizen science. So it's not to say we have all the solutions coming from citizen science. I think it's important to ask some searching questions in the same ways. I think we should ask those questions about academic activity. But for me, that's a kind of coming of age. You know, it's a sort of maturation process. It's perhaps now it's not about, well, is citizen science valid or not? It's very much about, well, how do we use that? What kind of questions should we be asking about it? And what's the relationship between citizen science and policy making on the one hand and academic research on the other?
Well, I think that's a good point on which to wrap up and leave everyone with that important message as food for thought. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today, Alan. It's been a great pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you, Miranda. That was very interesting for me too.
So I totally see your point, the point that you made just before Alan's interview there, Miranda, about the quality control question around the science that non-academic researchers are doing. But I also liked how he said, well, hey, maybe we need to change our approach, that maybe the policymakers need to kind of reframe how they're working with these people instead of kind of having it handed to them on a silver platter from the academics. Maybe it's engaging a bit more with the non-official researchers, let's call them, to get to that knowledge. I also thought it was interesting that he and Henrietta kind of said the same thing about the value of citizen science in terms of it asking new and different questions that scientists wouldn't have considered. I think Henrietta said that we can't keep asking the same questions because we'll just keep getting the same answers.
I think that what all this points to is that there is a need for maybe a real shift in mindset among some, perhaps within academic circles, but also beyond academia, you know, policymakers and anyone really trying to collate and use information to address societal issues or look at complex problems. Because although citizen science has been around for a long time, as Alan himself acknowledged, taking it more seriously and really using it as an incredibly powerful tool is maybe a newer thing. And yet, where it is being used, I mean, good examples are around a lot of the environmental things. Like, there was recent news in the UK about various species that are nearing extinction, and that will have all come from monitoring of different people in their gardens and so on. You know, this stuff is super powerful. So I think maybe it's all about this slight shift in mindset away from the ivory tower of academia being the only way that reliable information can be processed.
And going back to what Henrietta was saying at the beginning, that Alan somewhat echoed in terms of the power that this has for social unity and helping people come to terms with some of those big, overwhelming global challenges that can make you feel so small and helpless. If having a small connection to a bigger problem, whether it's counting the number of hedgehogs in your garden or collecting the plastic waste in a waterway near you, those can help you feel like you're actually doing something to solve some of those bigger problems.
It may also help with a sort of growing slight mistrust of experts and scientists in some corners of society by bringing it back into people's homes and giving it that greater transparency and inclusion so people don't see it as something that happens very separately from them.
It's really bringing home the scientific process for more people. Miranda, thank you so much for bringing us this episode. It's been really fascinating to listen to Henrietta, Joel, and Alan today.
It was a great podcast to put together.
Yes, thank you to Henrietta, Joel, and Alan, and thank you to you all for joining us today. And you can find more resources about citizen science and many other areas of best practice within higher education on campus. Go to timeshighereducation.com/campus. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.